Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. And today I'm talking to Kent Anderson. Kent has a pretty interesting background and a breadth of experience. He's the CEO and publisher of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, which is, you know, obviously a technical and scientific magazine or medical journal. And he also is one of the founders of a blog called The Scholarly Kitchen. Hi, Kent. How are you?
Good, David. How are you doing?
Good. It's really good to talk to you. Today is the first day of March, so we get to feel like maybe there is a possibility of spring.
Yeah, hope is in the air.
Absolutely. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your background. You have a pretty interesting and diverse set of experiences and connections into the book business.
Right, sure, I'd be happy to. So I've been actually in medical journals for about 20 years now. I was the director of medical journals at the American Academy of Pediatrics for a number of years. Then I was publishing director of the New England Journal of Medicine, and then an executive director at that organization. And this year I moved to the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery to be CEO and publisher. During that time, I have been writing my own books, as well as founding The Scholarly Kitchen, which is the official blog of the Society for Scholarly Publishing, and adding people there. So on The Scholarly Kitchen, I act both as a writer and as an editor.
So can you talk a little bit about the Society for Scholarly Publishing and just what is that?
Right. The Society for Scholarly Publishing is a group that works with individuals who have scholarly publishing as their profession to help them grow and develop as professionals. That's pretty much what it does. It's not an advocacy organization. It's just a professional organization for people to grow. And a couple of years ago, the president at the time stopped by my offices and was wondering how we could get more information out about the intellectual work of the society, of the people in it, basically. We had a research committee. We wanted to get more information out. And I said, well, why don't we start a blog? And she said, well, who would do that? And I said, well, I'd be happy to. And a day later, we had a blog up, and I wrote solo for a month or so, and the audience grew. And then we had a meeting, and people said, why don't you have other people blogging? And I said, I'd be happy to, and added a few people, and it's just grown since then. And now, we have, you know, 8 different contributors, and thousands and thousands of visitors a day. So,
yeah, it's a beautiful looking blog. I mean, you know, I've seen many, many blogs. Some of them are really nice, and some of them are exceptionally plain, or to say maybe not even attractive. And I think Scholarly Kitchen is very well laid out and pretty attractive. I'm really interested in one of your recent posts. I hope you don't mind talking about that. But you wrote a review of a book called You Are Not a Gadget,
right?
Why Open Culture and Technocentric Philosophies Are Ruining Our Lives, which is written by someone who I had not actually known about, Jaron Lanier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a long review, and I think, you know, you brought up a lot of the issues in the book. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that story.
Right, yeah. When I started Jaron's book, I'd heard of him, and I think I'd seen him speak once. He has a very distinctive set of dreadlocks, so he's very identifiable. I started the book, and I was dismissive of some of his arguments initially, but as I got into it, he broke me down. And there's a lot of what he says. There's a lot to it. It's a really great book, and it will definitely provoke you to think deeply about what's going on. A couple of things that really struck home for me was this whole idea that we need open culture, open data, open standards, open access, all of these open types of mentalities. They're breaking down the middle class of intellectual workers because you don't have, you know, reporters, beat reporters, you don't have session musicians who can flourish anymore, you don't have those types of things, and, you know, mid-tier editors and all of that, because the openness has evacuated that bit of the economy. And that economies around information, all economies are built on scarcity, but now that we have information abundance, we need to have artificial scarcity in order to make the information economy work. And then he ultimately points to the lack of creativity that the 2.0, Web 2.0 world has created. It really hasn't driven a lot of creativity. He says something in here that if I had started out back in the 80s, I had said in a quarter century when the digital revolution has made great progress and computer chips are millions of times faster than they are now, humanity will finally win the prize of being able to write a new encyclopedia and a new version of Unix. It would have sounded utterly pathetic. And so he is basically saying the open cultures have just recreated a world but lost its economic value and vitality, and in so doing, depleted creative energy.
I think it's an interesting argument, and I'm not even going to try to argue all the points here, but I think, you know, obviously there will be many people who will take issue with what he says and come up with other, you know, maybe say that he picks and chooses what he wants to use as evidence. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a really interesting, I mean, your review is really good. I think it's what I'm interested in is a sort of longer form of reviews that you know, address some of the issues in the book, in a book that you're writing about, which you've done. And I think I think it's a pretty valuable way to use the blog, essentially.
Right.
But it was a great review and an interesting enough book that it made me, you know, made me want to go out and get it. So
yeah.
I think that's probably one of the next books that I'll be reading.
Yeah, I went through it and ended up dog-earing so many pages. Which I usually don't do. I almost got to the highlighter stage.
Well, tell me. I mean, let's try to put that in the context of, let's say, of book publishing, which of course I'm interested in. How would you apply the argument, the linear argument, to what's going on in publishing now in terms of scarcity and value?
Right. Well, one of the, you know, newspapers, magazines, medical journals, books, they're all grappling with how do they price themselves. And you have people who are, you know, claiming success because they distribute 1,000 or 10,000 free copies of their book. But ultimately, I think you have to put prices on things. And that's how you create scarcity, is you say it's worth this much. And there will only be so many copies circulating. And that's, I think it just boils down to that. And then you also have the economic forces driving people to spend more time doing things creatively rather than doing things that are not as creative. So,
well, one of the current arguments among Web 2.0 or 3, you know, 2.5 advocates is that it's an attention economy, that mm-hmm. what you're really fighting for is the attention of the reader, because there is so much for a person to consume, whether
right.
it's reading or video or some other form of engagement. And it's not just on the web, but of course the web is the focus of that.
Right.
And I think that's the issue of value is still there,
mm-hmm.
because underlying the attention, it's what, if you can get somebody to pay attention to you, then what happens?
Right.
And, you know, is it, I think it's an interesting concept that if your price is really high, then you are communicating that you don't want too many people to buy whatever it is you're selling.
Yeah, I think we can fall into some traps there, though. I was just looking at some data, and I have a blog post on this upcoming about how consumers are actually quite willing to pay for content. And you look at how much, and there's another blog post on the Scholarly Kitchen about this. They actually are spending more for information than ever. They're just paying their cable company, or they're paying for an iPad or a Kindle or things like that.
Right, you're paying for the access.
Right, so those players are the ones who have innovated on the delivery mechanisms and the reading environments, not publishers, and that's an interesting point.
I think that's something I've talked about and written about, and that is that in some measure, then the creators have an argument with those gatekeepers, the ISPs and the iPad deliver, you know, the technology that delivers the information. Then the question is, who's paying for the content? If it's free to the user because you're essentially paying the road tax to get there, or if you sort of look at it as maybe it's the mall, the mall operator is getting the customers to come there. In this case, unlike the mall operator, you're actually getting a person to pay, let's say it's the cable company, it's $30 a month for internet access. All of that goes to your cable operator. None of it goes to the content providers.
Right, and I think that as you're starting to see some changes there, because the Associated Press is now getting money from Yahoo, and Google is settling up with various providers of news information to provide, you know, to pay licensing fees, essentially. And I think that that's, you know, as the media shift from print to online, economically, I think you're going to find more of those deals having to be struck. But you know, it's interesting because the attention economy argument, you know, that we had information scarcity, now we have information abundance, and now we have to compete for attention. Ultimately, the open world is very flat, and how do you compete for attention in a world where everything's open? You ultimately can do it by closing down a little bit and making your offering more scarce, harder to get at, and potentially more appealing.
Right, which is a different argument than I think most marketing practice. And I think, you know, what you see right now is a lot of marketers talking about how do you get noticed when everyone is available.
Right.
And so they're thinking of, how do I raise my head above that flat world, and somebody will see that I'm here. So I get, you know, maybe I put my really funny video up on YouTube and I get 4 million downloads, and then from that I can convert notoriety into some other form of value.
Right, but you have to be aware that you might also be the pets.com sock puppet.
Absolutely.
Where everybody knows your video, but they don't actually go to your store.
Right, and there's also a... But in a sense, that mimics the television world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, in the 50s and 60s, everyone who wanted to be somebody wanted to be on TV.
Right.
And maybe you wouldn't get paid, just for being on TV, but it would be a way of launching you into the consciousness of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's sort of like, you know, a writer wants to get reviewed in the New York Times as a way of being noticed. And
right.
So... since, you know, there may not be as many opportunities to be reviewed in the New York Times as there was 30 years ago, so you try to become somebody through this, by rising above the flatness. And what you're saying is the other way of looking at that is, in fact, do not try to rise above in the marketing way, but become someone that people want to find and then pay for, because there's a value.
Well, I think it's a balance. I was at a session recently where there were very carefully thought out business models and marketing approaches that were a balance, where certain pieces were free and certain pieces were paid for, and the free were used very consciously to, you know, get the kind of attention you're talking about and to draw people in, and then the paid was, you know, to make sure that the organization was sustainable and to, you know, show that there was more beyond that. And I think that's ultimately that's a very traditional approach.
Well, and I was thinking about that when I was reading your review of the Lanier book, that in a certain sense he's, out on one side taking a very radical position, and then you'll have people on the other side taking an equally radical position. And probably for most people who are thinking about this, there probably is a middle ground, but it's useful to hear the most radical views on both sides.
Definitely.
Because they make you think about what's going on.
Right.
And question, the received wisdom, which, you know, I think that notion too, that the web itself has created a sort of echo chamber where ideas that are not necessarily the most intelligent or persuasive, but become the most popular, become almost de facto rules.
Right, right. And Lanier has an interesting point. He has a lot of interesting points. I'll just say it's a book well worth reading. But one of them is that one piece of, you know, content that everybody is worshiping right now is advertising. And it's almost as if that's become sacrosanct. And it like you're saying, people have, you know, seen what's happened with Google. They're seeing what's happening with Facebook. It's as if advertising is now how you're going to make money. And so a lot of businesses are making business models along those lines. But ultimately, there's still a lot of reason to pursue the subscription model, to pursue the direct sales model, and all of those things.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, I think that the, so maybe it's a different context, but I think that the notion of going direct to consumer is really what many producers of content, whether it's, you know, books or video or music, I think the direct to consumer model or the principles of direct to consumer really have to be absorbed into their businesses or into their thinking about what they're doing, mm-hmm. because the web has created almost, whether it's, you know, not necessarily on purpose, but the disintermediation of the purveyors means that you can talk directly to your reader or your consumer. And maybe that's a good segue into the other kind of work that you do. I do want to, you know, touch on that, you know, you write fiction yourself, and you know, you're involved in another group of individuals working to promote your fiction.
Right. Yep. Yeah, so I write a series of mystery novels called the Johnny DeNovo Mysteries, and I'm also part of a writer's group called Backward Books, and it's a group of 9 authors who are elevating independent literary fiction, and they are fantastic writers. I've read a number of their books. I'm reading one right now, the latest edition, one of the latest additions to the group. We just added 2 members last month. And it's a fantastic book. It's just really, really interesting.
Now, so is the back, and it's B-A-C-K-W-O-R-D.
Correct. Backward.
Is this, and it's, you describe it as a collective. Are you individuals who live in the same place, or are you a gathering that's across different geographical areas?
Yeah, no, we live all across the country. People in New York, Maine, Massachusetts, California, Colorado, and a few other places. And the books are on various topics. They were identified by there's a website called Self-Publishing Review. And the editor of that, in doing book reviews, came across these authors. And also in the book scene, came across them and said, this set of authors is a cut above. And this would be a great group to put together to help elevate and show people what can be done by independent authors. And so, you know, one of our first goals was to get into Publishers Weekly, and we did that. Now we have some content. We had some contests going on. If you go to Smashwords, we have a set of interviews that we did that you can buy, and or actually you can get for free. You can either choose to pay us or get it free. There's that balance you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can read about, you know, how each author was inspired and how they work. But it's a great group, and we work really well together. And like I said, we've just added two members after probably about 9 months of the 7 of us. We've added 2 new members.
And so, and this works, is this set up so that the group of you work together to promote each other's books, or is this a publishing collective?
No, it's just a promotion collective at this point. We don't dictate how we publish, or we can use the imprint if we choose to set apart our books. Some of us do and some of us don't. That's optional. It's more a supportive collective and a marketing promotion collective.
And, well, I guess here's the interesting, you know, the question that this maybe addresses or raises, and that is, you know, there is still a notion which I find kind of strange that that purely saying that you're self-published means for some people, and I think incorrectly, but that there's a stigma to it because it means that you are not able to be published by a real publisher, as people will put it.
Right.
And, you know, I think that clearly in the current environment where traditional publishing is being challenged, that if you, and there are many, many more people writing today, I think, than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
There are more books to be published than it is possible for commercial or non-commercial publishers to publish.
Right.
And the notion that somehow a publisher is the seal of approval is challengeable, I think.
I agree. I think at least three of the authors in Backward books, if not four, have been traditionally published before and opted to publish independently after that. And everybody who has purchased my book that I has said anything to me believes that it's, you know, published by a traditional publisher. There's nothing to give, give away, if you will, that it's independently published. But I came at it from the perspective, a very analytical perspective. I'd kind of heard about self-publishing and print-on-demand services and all of this, but I was, you know, sending inquiry letters. And then I kept learning more about it and how little authors make using the traditional route, you know, especially first-time authors, and, you know, how long it takes to pay out. And I've actually published books in the past, and I know from that side it made me reflect. It's like, oh, boy, we, you know, publishers don't pay royalties willingly. You know, they hold back and they measure their markets, and they're very careful about that. So I sat back and I said, all right, so I could wait a year or two to go the traditional route, not make money, and have books on remainder and have books returned and pulped and go through all of that and not even be guaranteed my second book would get published or my third and so on. Or I could try it on my own. I'm a publisher. I should be able to do this. And sure enough, I was able to do it, and I was very happy with the results, and the reviews have been very, very good. And I have two books out and a third in the works. So,
well, I think it's really, it's a very interesting model, and it's probably a whole other conversation that we can have another time, and maybe what I'll do is I'll read one of your books, and then I can interview you here as an author.
I'd be happy to send you one.
Well, thanks so much, Ken. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that we've touched on some interesting things. I think we have. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, and I've been talking today with Kent Anderson, who I think is probably identifiable as one of the founders of the Scholarly Kitchen, as well as a self-published and active author. Thanks so much, Kent.
Thanks, David.